Thank you, Tom, and good afternoon, everyone. It was my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Arthur Brooks. Arthur is the president of the American Enterprise Institute, AEI, and holds the Beth and Ravenel Curry Chair in Free Enterprise. He has been AEI's president since 2009, a period of significant growth and enhanced success of the Institute. Since 2009, AEI's revenues have nearly doubled, and AEI has jumped to the forefront in government testimony, op-ed placements, and other audience-focused metrics. Under his leadership, AEI has become the leading think tank defending free enterprise and human flourishing. Prior to becoming president of AEI, Arthur was a visiting scholar at the Institute during his tenure at Syracuse University, where he held joint positions in business and public policy. Before that, he was on the faculty of Georgia State University and then earned his PhD at Rand Graduate School. Arthur came to academia and public policy late in life and in a somewhat unconventional way. You see, after high school, Arthur pursued a career as a professional French hornist, serving from 1983 to 1989 with the Annapolis Brass Quartet, and from 1989 to 1992 with the City Orchestra of Barcelona, where he met and married his wife, Esther. After that, he came back to America and earned a bachelor's degree when he was 30 years old. Arthur has been very busy since that time. Arthur is the author of over 100 articles and 10 books, including the New York Times bestseller, The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. Please join me in welcoming my friend Arthur Brooks, one of America's best and most articulate speakers.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you so much. What an honor to be here at Forum Club here in beautiful Naples. It's warmer here than the rest of America, and that's actually why most of you are here, I think. It's wonderful to see Bill Stavropoulos. He was on the board of the American Enterprise Institute for a long time before I came, but he's responsible for part of the success of my institution. He told you a little bit about my background. AEI is a think tank that's been in Washington, D.C. since 1938. It is an institution dedicated to the proposition that maximizing liberty, increasing individual opportunity, and fighting for free enterprise gives the most people the best life. Nothing about business, nothing about economics per se, but about giving more people a better life. And that's what I want to talk about today. What do we know about giving more people a better life? What we're trying to look at the American Enterprise Institute. Well, to understand this, you have to look at a paradox that we see around us today. The world has grown phenomenally richer over the last few decades. Not everybody in the United States over the course of the Great Recession, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, but the world has grown tremendously richer, including the United States. But as that has happened, you don't see that people are happier. You don't see that people are more satisfied with their lives. From 1991 to today, the percentage of people who are dissatisfied with their personal lives has increased by two-thirds. Even worse, what percentage of Americans are satisfied with the United States, their own country? 1991, it was 48%. That's not high enough. But only 48% were dissatisfied with the United States. That's a problem. Today, 75% of Americans are dissatisfied with our country. The richest country in the history of the world, and 3 out of 4 are dissatisfied with the direction that our country is going. Something's wrong. Something's not right. Now, to begin with, I got to answer this question. Why is it that if we are generally, notwithstanding the recession, moving in the right direction economically, people are less satisfied with their lives? Now, I've written a lot about happiness, and when I talk about happiness, I like to ask experts in the field. So I want to tell you about a visit where I asked the question about that paradox that I think you might find interesting. I go to India a lot. because we have a lot of work in my institution going on in India. And I had heard about a year ago about a Swami in New Delhi who thought an awful lot about capitalism. He thought an awful lot about free enterprise. And somebody said, you got to go talk to this guy. His name is Gyan Muni. You got to go talk to him about these questions that you have about dissatisfaction and prosperity. And I said, fine, I'll talk to anybody. And I went to the temple, this beautiful ornate temple. It took 10,000 stone cutters 7 years full time to construct. It's a real wonder of Indian civilization. And I was waiting for him, and I was thinking, Swami Gyan Muni, I wonder if he speaks English. This is going to be tough. And I see him coming toward me, and he's wearing a saffron robe, and he's got a shaved head. And when he gets up to me, he says, how you doing? And I was really taken for a loss, and I said, Swami, where are you from? And Swami said, Texas. And I said, you got to tell me your story, Swami. He says, oh, sure. I was born in Houston. My parents were petroleum engineers. I grew up in the great city of Houston. I went to the University of Texas on a full scholarship. I graduated summa, and I got my MBA. Finished by the time I was 22 years old with the whole thing. I was a great student, he said. And I said, oh, that's terrific. You're still not telling me how you wound up in a saffron robe with your head shaved in a temple in Delhi. He says, oh, I was climbing the corporate ladder for several years. It was going great. But I got into my late 20s, and one day I woke up and I said, is this it? Is this all there is, making money? Or is there more to life? He said, I thought about it and I prayed about it. And finally I decided I was on the wrong track. I said, what did you do? He said, I sold everything, gave up all my worldly possessions, and I went to a Hindu seminary in India, and I studied intensively for 6 years, and I became a monk. I emerged, and I have a new life. I own nothing. I said, nothing? He said, well, not literally. I own four things. He said, two robes, so that he has a change of clothes, prayer beads, and a begging bowl, a bowl for my food made of wood. That's it. I said, oh, man, I'm really nervous about this question I got to ask you, Swami. He said, what is it? I said, what's your view of capitalism? Right? Now, I know I'm going to get an earful. I know that Swami's going to tell me that abundance is bad, that capitalism is corrupting, that free enterprise is wrecking the world with possessions. That's not what he said. He said, capitalism? It's great. It's pulled hundreds of millions of people in my country out of poverty and saved them from starvation. It's not what I was expecting. So I was backpedaling at this time. I said, but you don't own anything. You don't believe in possessing anything. Don't you think that abundance and prosperity are corrupting on people? I said, no. Money is great. The problem is attachment to money. And a light bulb went off. See, I've learned my whole life, I've heard and you've heard, the words of St. Paul. Yeah, here's how you remember the words of St. Paul. Money is the root of all evil. That's not what he said. Remember this, St. Paul, in his letter to Timothy, for the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith, and pierce themselves through with many sorrows. Money won't hurt you, but the love of money will. Swami Gyan Muni told me this. He said that abundance is fine, but not if you're attached to it. Here's how he put it. Get a Mercedes, but don't love it. Very evocative. Well, he was talking to me about attachment. Attachment. It's a very Eastern-sounding concept. What does attachment mean? There's a word in the Sanskrit language, the ancient language that's the basis of Hindi and most Indian languages. And the word in Sanskrit for attachment is upadana. Upadana. What does it mean? Here's what it means. It's very evocative. It's the sticky craving for inadequate things. It means the debased substitutes for the truth that we seek. Isn't this great about Buddhism? They have one word that means all that. the sticky craving for the things that you seek, but they're inadequate in life. That's what attachment means. It's not that you attach to these things. They attach to you, as far as the Buddhists and Hindus are concerned. It's a desperate grasping, motivated by a fear of separation from the object. Now, one sees attachment in lots of things in life. You can see attachment that's unhealthy in jealous relationships. You can see attachment in a neurotic defense of one's professional reputation. I see this in Washington, D.C. all the time. I mean, I run a big institution in D.C. I live in Washington, so you don't have to. And let me tell you, you see some sad things because people are so desperately attached to their reputation. But the big area of attachment, and the reason I was in Delhi that day, was to talk about attachment to material things. Why do people become so attached to material things? And the answer is this: disordered goals. I'm going to tell you about a wonderful experiment, and this is not from Eastern religion. This is from the University of Rochester, about as far from Delhi as you can get. In 2009, two researchers, two psychologists, did a very interesting experiment where they interviewed graduating seniors, and then they followed up 5 years later to see how their lives were turning out. What did they interview them about? They interviewed them about their life goals. They said, what do you want in the next 5 years? And then 5 years later, they came back and said, did you get it? And how's your life going? Okay, now that's an interesting thing. Take yourself back to when you were 22. Right? Take yourself back to what you wanted. Thank you. What did you want when you were 22? Well, the researchers found in interviewing 147 graduates that they fell into two types of categories. Those who had what they called intrinsic goals and those who had extrinsic goals. What does that mean? That's just social science talk. What does it mean? Intrinsic goals were about relationships. These are people who said, in the next 5 years, I want to have a good relationship with my family. I want to get married. I want to understand God more. Those were people who had intrinsic goals. That was half the kids. It's good news. The other half had extrinsic goals, which was, I want to get rich and famous. It was basically, I want to have a lot of professional esteem. I want to make a lot of money. I want to be on track to be in the corner office. Extrinsic goals. Okay. They followed up 5 years later. What do they find? They found good news and bad news. First, the good news. Everybody hit their goals. Everybody hit their goals. This is something, you know when you've heard that you should be careful what you wish for? It's empirically true. You're going to hit your goals. All of us are. That's what the research says. People who wanted to have better relationships got better relationships. People who wanted to make money were making money. People who wanted to have a good reputation professionally, they had a good reputation professionally. They were on the management track. Here's the bad news. The kind of goals you have determine how happy your life is. People who had intrinsic goals, better relationships with people and God, those people were happy. Those people were well-adjusted. Those people were satisfied with their lives. Those who had extrinsic goals, here are the findings: shame and anger, headaches, stomach aches, dissatisfaction with life, loss of energy. Sounds good, doesn't it? That sounds good. Is it worth being CEO for that? Now, religion has always taught us this. You don't need a PhD in psychology to tell you this. Right? Ecclesiastes 5:10. Whoever loves money never has enough. Isn't that the truth? Whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. Look, this is as old as the hills. What Swami Gyan Muni told me is in the book of Ecclesiastes. We just keep forgetting it over and over. Why? Why isn't this eternal truth more seriously understood by people? Why do people keep making this mistake? The answer is that society conspires to keep us in the dark. There are interests to make sure that extrinsic goals in society are rewarded and called the most important ones. Fame and notoriety, material and money. That's what Hollywood tells us. That's what Madison Avenue tells us. That's what television and the media are telling us all the time. Get that car and you'll be happy. Get more famous and you'll be happy. Post on Facebook, you'll be happy. Oh, no, you won't. There's a study from the University of Michigan that shows looking at people over a four-week period, that shows very clearly the more you post to social media, the less happy you will be. And every post makes you unhappier than the last. That's attachment. That's attachment. That's building your own little fan base. And it's a mistake. Basically, the world gives you a formula. You know what the formula from the world is? Love things and use people. That's the wrong formula. The right formula is love people and use things. And that's what we have to remember. We have to get back to Swami Gyan Muni's axiom that the secret to a happy life is abundance without attachment. So here's my question. How do you get non-attachment? I'm just a Westerner. I'm just a guy from the United States who studied economics and music and a few other things, but I certainly didn't go to a Hindu seminary, let me tell you. So how do I get non-attachment? How do I get it? Here's how we get it. Here's how each one of us gets it. Number one. If you love something, give it away. This is the key. You know, it's the funniest thing that we forget this, but this is a very ancient teaching, that detachment comes from charity. Detachment comes from generosity. Think about what you're attached to and then give it away. My main area of research when I was at Syracuse University was philanthropy. And you heard this in the invocation, which I appreciated very much, by the way, that charity is the secret to a better life. It was extraordinary. When I was teaching at Syracuse University, I had these data on charitable giving, and I was, you know, looking at and doing the data analysis in my office, in, you know, a darkened office on my computer, and I kept finding this weird thing. When people give more money away, they get richer as a result, as a causal result of giving their money away. Now, I couldn't believe it. I didn't believe it. So I did what all researchers do when they don't believe their research. They throw their research away. Right? I ignored it. I didn't think. And then I found that in the United States, over a longitudinal period, over a long period of years, when people give more, when Americans give more, as a result of it, GDP goes up. A lot. A dollar given by Americans causes an increase of $19 and increased GDP. So I went to a friend of mine who was a psychologist, and I said, I have these weird results that I can't believe. I find that you get richer when you give money away. He said, what are you talking about? Why is that a problem? Why is that such a mystery to you? We've known that for 30 years. What do you mean? He says, oh, well, we don't talk about money. We talk about what matters more. I said, what matters more than money? He said, happiness. When people give more, they get happier. Of course they become more prosperous when they're happier because they're more effective. And if absolutely it's true. You find there are research that shows that people get happier, they become more effective, their stress levels fall, they're seen as leaders, they get richer. There's actually a very interesting study that's related to this. This is brand new. This comes from the University of Liverpool, where the researchers, they wanted to see how good-looking you are if you give money away. How good-looking you are, right? Okay, so what did they do? They recruited a bunch of guys to do the experiment. They said, here's the deal. You have to show up to the experiment with your girlfriend. Okay? And some of them were showing up with women that they'd been dating for a year and some for just a week. And they showed up and they went to the building where they had to do the experiment, and the researcher says, here's the whole experiment. You walk from this building to that building. When you get over there, I'm going to interview you. Okay. So they're walking with their girlfriends. They walk with the girlfriends, and there's an alleyway between the buildings, and a hobo comes walking out of the alleyway and panhandles the guy. Right now. Okay. They get to the next building, and the researchers do an interview. They interview the man, and they say, how much money did you give the panhandler? And then they ask his girlfriend, how attractive do you find him right now? And what do they find? The more money you give the hobo, the better looking you are to your girlfriend. So guys, here's news you can use. Who says social science isn't hugely practical, right? Giving makes you healthier, happier, richer, and more beautiful. Why? Because basically you're in the practice of giving away that which you hold most dear. The non-attachment experience is enriching to your life. That's practice number one. Give more. Give more of that which you treasure. Second, focus less on the price of things. Focus more on the value of experiences. You know, there's an ad for the credit card, for MasterCard, that all of you have seen. It's a very annoying, cloying commercial. But it has a profound message behind it. It's a series of ads. You've seen it. It has a lot of variants to it. And in the ad, there is somebody who's in the act of having an experience talking about the price of the ancillary goods and services. I'll give you an example. There's a man who is getting ready to go to the beach with his son. Okay, and it shows, and it's listing the things that he has to buy. Beach ball, $3. Gas for the car, $36. Two nights in a hotel, $275. The weekend at the beach alone with my son, priceless. Very profound message. The value of experiences with those whom we love is so much greater than the price of things. Don't make the mistake of thinking that the things are more valuable than the experiences. Here's the insight. We think that physical things are permanent and that experiences are evanescent. It's exactly the reverse that's true. Think about your own life. It's the things that go away. It's the experiences that last forever. Right? My wife and I, at one point, early in our marriage, we had no money. We were, you know, deciding whether or not we should go away for the weekend or whether we should get a couch. Right? a weekend is over in 3 days, but a couch is something we'll have forever. Wrong. You know, we've been married 25 years now. We don't remember the couch. We remember the weekend. That's what sticks with you. There's a lot of research to this. I'm not going to trouble you with it. Let me tell you how I really, really learned this, because it's on my mind right now. I have a house full of teenagers. Pity me. I mean, we got the greatest high school kids in Collier County here, so I say this with appropriate humility. But I have high school kids, and one of my sons, his name is Carlos, 5 years ago, Carlos, he said, "Dad, I've been thinking about Christmas." I said, "That's good. What are you thinking about Christmas, Carlos?" And he said, "I'm thinking that this year, I don't want anything." I said, "Huh?" He said, "I mean, I don't want anything. I want to go away with you hunting and fishing, just the two of us. That's all I want for Christmas." Oh. You know, that's actually 19 times more expensive than the thing he would have asked for. But yeah, thanks, Carlos. Yeah, that's great. And we did it. And we've done it every year since. Last week, I was here. I was here in Collier County. I was actually up in Clewiston, and we were shooting wild boar. And then we went light tackle fishing off Marco Island. So beautiful. I can tell you, everything Carlos and I have caught and everything that we've shot every single year. If I bought him something, a scooter or a bike or a toy or some junk, it'd all be broken, it'd all be gone, it would all be forgotten by me and by him. The experiences that we have are forever. Carlos taught me that non-attachment comes from the valuation of experiences as opposed to the price of things. This is the way that we build our relationships. The love on which non-attachment to material things is truly based. Now, I told you about non-attachment, but there's a little sleight of hand. Swami's formula for a happy life: abundance without attachment. It's okay to have the Mercedes, just don't love it. I talked about not loving it. Now let's talk about the Mercedes. He even said, abundance is great. It pulled people out of starvation in my country. That's true. Swami knows what he's talking about. Let me tell you why non-attachment is not the only thing that's important, but abundance is important too. And I want to encourage each one of us to fight for abundance as long as we're not attached. When I was a kid, growing up in Seattle, in a lower middle class family, there were a lot of poor people in my neighborhood. Nobody went to college. There's a lot of crime and drugs. That seemed to me pretty normal. In retrospect, it seems pretty austere. But everybody knew even then that it wasn't real poverty. You can find real poverty by looking outside the United States. You know, when I was a kid, I remember the first experience that I ever had with real poverty. It was, you know, my brother had a subscription to the National Geographic. You had this experience too. 1970, take your back. If you were alive in 1970, think about that year. Think about a picture that you saw of somebody in sub-Saharan Africa in 1970. What was the picture? It was a kid with a distended belly and flies on his face. Remember that? And you remember that sensation that you had? You said, I can't do anything about that. It was the sense of impotence that you were unable to help. You could put, you know, money in the basket. You could give alms to the poor. You could offer up a prayer. But you weren't going to solve this problem, and that boy was going to die. You remember that? What happened from 1970 to today? We grew up. We went on with our lives. We got married. We got jobs. Did the world get better or get worse? 70% of Americans think there's more hunger today than there was in 1970. Those Americans who think that are wrong. From 1970 to 2012, the percentage of the world's population living at starvation levels has declined by 80%. 80%. A world that was almost universally poor is almost universally not from 1970 to today. There's too much poverty, and I believe we're commanded to deal with that poverty. But an 80% decline. What happened? Well, we weren't looking. Well, we were just going about our lives. Was it the United Nations World Food Program or the World Bank or the IMF or U.S. Foreign Aid? No. Those things are good or bad, depending on your point of view. It was five things that created the abundance that pulled 2 billion people out of the jaws of starvation. You know what they were? Globalization, free trade, property rights, the rule of law, and entrepreneurship. In short, you know what it was? It was you. It was your American free enterprise system that spread around the world after 1970 that pulled billions of people away from death. The reason that somebody in some village in China you'll never see and you'll never meet is going to school today is because of you and your free enterprise system. A kid in a village in Africa you've never heard of won't starve to death, will grow up and be able to work and have a family because of that. That is the only thing that has created prosperity and abundance in the history of the world and is yours. It's your gift to the world. This is why the fight for free enterprise from my institution and inside your hearts is so critically important. This is the reason I go to work every day and that my 200 colleagues at AEI have given up other careers to come to the American Enterprise Institute, because we know that the case for free enterprise is not another dollar in the pocket of a billionaire. It's the difference between starvation and thriving for the poorest people in the world. That's why abundance is important. That's why you and I have to fight for abundance. It's not just abundance of money either, by the way. It's an abundance of freedom. It's an abundance of independence. It's an abundance of dignity. And truly, America made that possible. And you, who are advocates for the free enterprise system, are the Americans who made this possible. Congratulations, and God bless you, and thank you for doing that, because the world wouldn't have it otherwise. So where are we? There's a paradox out there. A richer world that's less satisfied. The solution for all of us is abundance without attachment. We have two assignments. We have two assignments. Fight for an economic system that creates the most abundance for people in the world, and that is the free enterprise system. And fight for the private moral values to enjoy the fruits of this system without attachment. Those are our two goals, our two assignments. That's not a political movement, and that is not an economic movement. That's a social movement. I invite you to join me and my colleagues to create a better world for everyone, to fight for free enterprise, but also for human consciousness, to fight for material prosperity, but also the wisdom to use it right. That's a radical departure from the ideologies you're hearing coming from Washington, D.C. Let me tell you, that is not right-wing and that is not left-wing. That is humanistic in these values, and all of us can engage in this no matter where you are on the political spectrum. Now, if you agree with me and you fight for this, some of your friends are going to think you're a little weird, but you're going to do a lot of good for the world, and your legacy will be that much richer for it. You will be a force for a better world, for your fight, for your affections, for what you're doing, and for the world you've built. God bless you, and thank you.
Okay. I told you it's thought-provoking and articulate. We have a lot of questions. We'll try to get through as many as we can. How do you convince Obama that capitalism works?
Yeah, that's a little loaded. It's a, how do you convince Obama that, that capitalism works? Well, you know, look at President Obama's life. Capitalism works. You know, President Obama would have been poor 100 years ago. He wasn't, because capitalism works. He would not have gone to college 100 years ago. He went to college, the best colleges, because capitalism works. The fact is that we reward people who are smart and excellent, that we move from a world that's largely bigoted and closed off to people without privilege, that through competition we move to a world that actually does reward people regardless of their religion and regardless of their race, is the reason he's president of the United States. He's living, breathing proof that free enterprise is the best system to serve everybody, no matter where they come from. He's Exhibit A.
Excellent. Why do you believe that seemingly intelligent, successful people want to do away with God and religion, especially in the schools and public places?
Do we have any other questions?
Yeah.
one of the many great things about the United States is that, as you may have perceived, I'm a religious person. Many of you are too. We're not all the same religion. The point is that the United States is arguably the most religious country in the world, precisely because we have a free market for religious beliefs. And the way that you make sure you have a free market for religious beliefs is by making sure there's competition, and you make sure there's competition by not establishing a religion by the government. That's the reason the framers wanted to do that. If you are a friend of faith, if you believe that religion is a good thing in American society, you have to be a warrior for the separation of church and state. That's what Thomas Jefferson understood, and that's what we all still have to understand today. That's really a big deal. I mean, I'm a Roman Catholic. We have the former ambassador to the Vatican here, Francis Rooney, Catholic. What would we have been able to do if there were an establishment of a religion? You know, the original church that people wanted to establish as the state church in the United States was the Congregational Church, a Protestant church that's relatively small right now, but it was very important when it was first established. We would not even be welcome as Roman Catholics in this country. And look at all of you, different faiths, no faith, and we can sit together and think about the greatness of our country. That's what we have to do. Now, it should never metastasize into a hostility toward religion, because religion, faith, is truly, for many people, for most Americans, is one of the sources of a happy life. At the same time, making sure that the government stays where the government is supposed to be and religion stays in our hearts as private individuals, and we separate that, we keep it private, is the secret to the strength of faith in America.
Excellent. Can you comment on the relationship between healthy attachment to experience and the unhealthy attachment to capturing every moment of the experience in pictures, videos, and posts?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. This is a different phenomenon. So, sure, you can have an unhealthy attachment to experience. And the reason is because, and this is another concept that you get from Buddhists, I have a wonderful friendship and collaboration with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He comes to AEI, and I meet him in his ashram in Dharamsala, India. And we're working on a collaboration we did last year, we're going to do this year. And one of the things that I've learned from the Dalai Lama, learned a great deal from my association with the Dalai Lama, is that the key to a healthy relationship to experiences is a concept called mindfulness. What's mindfulness? Well, there's a large literature on that says, when you're washing the dishes, wash the dishes. I mean, this is very Buddhist, okay, so bear with me, right? When you're drinking a cup of coffee, drink a cup of coffee. When you're driving home today, drive home today. What does that mean? It's not just babbling. What that is be where you are right now. The problem that we have with unhealthy relationships to our experiences is that we're someplace else. You know, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to make sure that this, you know, this boat ride today gives me the best photos. Right? I'm going to make sure that you know, Christmas morning, that I can get the best photographs of what's going on here so that I can actually tweet this stuff. Right? No. Stupid. Don't do that. Live in that moment. If you're going to enjoy the experiences, you have to be mindful of the moment of that experience. If you're living in the future or you're living in the past, you're wasting the present, and wasting the present is the secret to not enjoying your life.
Excellent. How can you get AEI's story out, especially to the politicians, so they get it?
Yeah. That's why Bill was on the board of AEI. I mean, that's why among our audience, we have supporters of our institution out here, was to get the impact of these messages. Look, I'm not going to ask, you know, the senators and congressmen to go talk to the Swami. That's not my point. What I'm trying to do is get the abundance part and the moral importance of American prosperity through free enterprise into their heads so they can make the moral case for it. How are we doing it? Next week, next Thursday, I'm going on retreat with the senators and congressmen from the Republican Party. I'd go with the Democrats, but they didn't invite me, right? Maybe they will at some point. But I'm going out of town. I'm going to Pennsylvania with the Republicans, and we're going to talk about exactly how to express these sentiments. This is what we're, we have a government affairs department. At the same time, we're on hundreds of college campuses across the United States. At the same time, my colleagues and I will do 350 events around the United States. We will get in not just to the minds of the policymakers, but the business leaders, the media leaders, the academic leaders, and the community leaders, because everybody deserves to be a hero, to bring a better life to more people. Every one of you in this room is a leader. Every one of you has an opportunity to touch the lives of people who follow you and respect you. If we can talk in this particular way, we make everybody better off, and this is our gift. How are we doing it for the policymakers? We're talking to them in debate training. We're doing testimony on the Hill. We're writing papers and op-eds and books that they and their staffs are reading. We're more involved, actually, in the congressional, in the legislative process than any other think tank in America today, because, in particular, they need to be able to express these ideas and to make laws and policies on the basis of it.
Excellent. What advice do you give your children in terms of planning for the future?
Don't forget your old dad when he's living in Naples. Yeah. You know, the funniest thing about this is, you know, I told you how I started thinking about experiences over things. Carlos didn't learn that from me. I learned that from Carlos. We listen to each other about the things that truly move our hearts. You try to think about the things that are important, remembering the intrinsic things as opposed to the instrumental things. You know, in a way, it was easier for me when I was a kid because we didn't have any material things and we're more materially prosperous. My kids live in a suburb of Washington called Bethesda, Maryland. They're living in a dollhouse, right? And there's no crime and drugs in the neighborhood. Nothing ever happens, and everybody's just alike, as a matter of fact. But when we understand the intrinsic things about what's important about being a person, that values matter most, then we can have these types of conversations. The truth of the matter is, this is what we talk about at the kitchen table. We talk about the idea of abundance without attachment. We talk about the idea of loving people and only ever using things. These are the values that matter most, and that's how values incidentally are propagated. Values are not propagated by creating a new government agency, the Department of Values. No. Values are propagated because people who trust and love each other talk about the things that are really, really, really important, the things that are most morally important. We do it, and I do it the same way that you do, is by talking to your kids and listening.
Excellent. What threat does radical Islam present to your premise and to the free enterprise system?
Radical Islam, yeah, is the, it's basically the ideological Ebola in our world today. And if you don't believe it, Look at the newspaper about what's going on in France. It's the most astoundingly naive thing I've heard in the last 2 days was somebody on TV saying, sooner or later, this is going to happen in America. Huh. It did at the Boston Marathon. Two brothers declaring jihad tried to blow up a bunch of strangers, killed 4 people and injured 30. Same thing that happened in France. This is a problem. This is a problem. How are you going to solve it? That's a more complicated issue than what we're talking about here. But let me tell you that one of the things that we have to do to solve this is by sharing our values confidently around the world. Confidence in your values is what brings others to them magnetically. St. Paul, his letter to the Ephesians, what did he say? Be good to each other. Show love for each other. Live with virtue and talk confidently about these things. Why? Not because you're going to go beat somebody over the head and say, you're going to become this, you know, join this little religion called Christianity. No. He wanted to magnetize his views, and then the pagans would be drawn to him. That's what we're supposed to do as Americans. That's what we're supposed to do. Confidence in our, not backing off our values and saying, oh, you know, we got to be more sensitive to people who don't believe in freedom of expression. No. Our values are that we're so confident that we can put up with things that even insult us. And when people see that, they're going to do the same thing that happened after 1970 with free enterprise. They're going to say, I want that. I'm going to throw off the shackles of dictatorship and the shackles of poverty, and I'm going to go out and get that. We have to do the same thing culturally that we did economically, and that starts with a confidence that we are doing what's right, and we want to share it with others.
Here's a personal question. Can you tell us about your own faith experience?
No. I mean, it's the same as 30% of Americans. No, 76% of Americans, 96% of Americans. I'm a Catholic. You know, I grew up in a good, solid home. The Christian parents. I'm actually a Catholic convert when I was a teenager, when I was in high school. I guess it was a little bit of healthy rebellion. And I dedicate my life to trying to serve others the same way that so many of you do too. While working in the public sphere, working with people who don't share my religious views, which is fine, but trying to find the from my own religious experience, the values that I need to share with others. This is, again, this is the secret to the American religious experience, is not beating people over the head with it, but sharing it in all of its good qualities, such that in a plurality of religion that separates church from state, we can all benefit from the faith of the other.
Good. I want to close with the one final question from a student. What inspired you to pursue the career that you chose?
Yeah. What inspired me to choose the career that I chose? It was a long and winding path. You know, you didn't mention it, Bill. You said I went to actually into music right after high school. I didn't. I went to college for a year, and you know, there's some debate as to whether I dropped out or got kicked out after my freshman year in college, which ended with less than 1 year of credits. And I learned something. I learned something very very important, which is that it's more important to take your required classes than to take classes in Balinese dancing. So, good to know. Good to know. And you know, they were very encouraging to me to pursue my excellence elsewhere, outside the college. And I didn't make it back. Look, don't try this at home, kids. This is not the example that I want to give. And I wound up back in college in my late 20s and got my college degree right around the time of my 30th birthday. What I wanted to do when I was a kid, all I wanted to do was to play music. I wanted to be a professional classical French horn player. That's all I wanted to do. I knew it since I was 8 years old. I was good at it. I loved it. And that's what I did. I did that all the way through my 20s. I drove a van with 4 other guys across the United States without only stopping for gas. It took 52 hours. I saw 15 countries and 50 states of the Union by the time I was 22. I toured with a guitar player named Charlie Bird. A jazz guitar player named Charlie Bird for 2 years. Fantastic. I lived the dream. I was also poor. And by the time I got married, I realized I wanted to do something else and got a PhD and became an economist and wound up in this winding path. The point is basically this. Listen to what you're good at and where you can serve others. The ambition should be where you can serve the most, where you can be the best servant. And that will take you in so many different places. Why? Because The American free enterprise system makes it possible for all of your skills to transfer from one area of life to another, and that's the secret to a life that's really an adventure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Arthur. Thank you very much, Bill. We are adjourned.